Welcome to another episode of The Sword and Pen, a podcast dedicated to inspiring, educating, and highlighting our military veterans and journalism members. I am your host, Lori King, and I thank you for listening. On this episode, we are going back to the school that kickstarted both of our journalism careers, the Defense Information School, or DINFOS as we call it. DINFOS was established in 1964 and is the premier learning institute for military journalists, broadcasters, and public affairs professionals. It is now located at Fort Meade, Maryland, but when Lance and I went to AIT there, it was at Fort Ben Harrison, Indiana, right outside of Indianapolis. DINFOS now offers 19 courses and trains about 2,600 DINFOS trained killers a year. Yes, we call ourselves DINFOS trained killers, and I don't know why. So if anyone knows where that moniker came from, please reach out and let me know. Lance, do you know where that came from?
I just know it was on a t-shirt I bought when I was an instructor there. So it works for me.
Do you still have that t-shirt?
I do.
Oh, that's awesome.
In fact, they have a whole new version of them that they've created. And someone keeps sending me notes to say, you want to buy a new one?
I need to reach out and buy one. I need to wear that t-shirt.
Yeah, for sure.
My guest is Lance Milstead, who used to be a broadcast instructor there and is now Chief of Production Services at DoD's Defense Media Activity, or DMA. DINFOS is a component of DMA, which is also at Fort Meade. Lance, I am so excited to talk about DINFOS. I went through AIT and multiple advanced courses there and definitely have fond memories, especially that feeling I got like I was going through college. But instead of taking filler courses like English and science and math, you pretty much are doing journalism 100% of the time. I was only 18 when I attended DINFOS and had no idea at the time that it was the beginning of a very long journalism career that is still ongoing. But when you attended back in 1984, you knew exactly what you wanted to be, a broadcast journalist. So for this episode, we're going to talk about the broadcast journalism profession, then and now, what it was like teaching broadcast journalism at DINFOS, and what DMA is and what you do there. Before we begin, let's get to know you a bit. You hail from Wisconsin, so let's go back to your hometown during your junior high and high school days, because really that's where your journey begins. Take us back to those early days when you went from playing football to wanting to be an actor, to working at your high school radio station on a 10-watt station, to settling on broadcast journalism in the military, even though I wouldn't call that settling because, you know, it's who you are. Is it true that you ended up in broadcast journalism because the military didn't have a job for actors? So you settled on being on the radio because it was as close to entertaining as you can get. I think that's pretty cool.
I think that's pretty close. Yeah. So grew up in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and was attending Horseman Junior High School playing football in my seventh grade year and hurt my Achilles tendon. And that sort of ended the football thing. I played football because that's what you did around Sheboygan as a young guy in high school. That fall, the school had a fall play and I went and saw it. I'm like, wow, that looks fun. Being up on stage and acting and doing that. So the spring play came around. I tried out, got a part, and fell in love with, I had a small part, but it was cool. I liked being on stage. I liked performing. I sang in choir at church. So it was sort of part of what things I was doing already. And I just stuck with it through junior high, all the way through my senior high year. Final thing I did as a actor in high school, I played Danny Zuko in Grease my senior year. So that was like just the highlight. It was so cool. And yeah, I wanted to be an actor. I did my career paper on being an actor. I wanted to be an actor because I wanted to be famous and I wanted to make a lot of money. And in hindsight, that's really not the right reason to do anything. The reason you want to do something is because it's something you believe in and you got a passion in. And, you know, joining the Army and starting a career as a broadcaster was really to get the college money to go to be an actor. You know, I got my start in broadcasting because our high school had a radio station and you could take a class where you learned about broadcasting and communications. You earned a FCC license, which you had to have to be on the radio back then. You don't now. And then you got to take and do air shifts on the radio, which was cool. It was like performing, except it's you and a microphone talking to, you know, a couple hundred of your best friends. A couple hundred, because that's probably all that listened to our high school station. But I had a lot of fun. And it led to, you know, DJing sock hops and dances for the school. When it came time to figure out what I want to do after high school, my parents was pretty plain. They said, we can't afford to send you to college. So you're going to have to figure that out. Either take college loans out or join the military or whatever. So I decided that I'd look into what the Army had to offer. And they had a public affairs broadcast journalist position. And when I asked about that, you know, because, you know, they're trying to, you know, hey, here, this field artillery, and this is the Rangers, and this is special forces. And I'm like, what about communications or broadcasting? They said, yeah, we got this public affairs broadcast journalism thing. I said, that's it. Sign me up. So it was a done deal. And that's sort of how I got into the military. My goals were to join, do 3 years, get out and go to school to be an actor. But that's not really what happened. I re-enlisted and went to Korea and started learning more. Because, you know, you're young and you're sort of, for me, I was forming this impression of what it meant to be a communicator in the military. I didn't really get that until later on in my career. But, you know, I think that's part of growing up and maturing, is learning more. And then as you experience more things, you have a better appreciation for what it is you get to do for a career.
So you're 18 and you go off to basic training and then you show up at DINFOS. We were talking about confidence and how you had an abundance of it before you even walked into DINFOS for the first time. Back in 1984, you're 18, you're right out of high school. You show up at this renowned military journalism school and you think you had it made. You think you knew you think you knew everything because you were a DJ for your high school 10-watt radio station. But that's not what happened.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was a big wake-up call for me. I mean, you know, they start with the spiel that this is like the second hardest school in the Army. And, you know, we're pouring into 3 months, which you would learn in 4 years in college. And I didn't even have to worry about that because I couldn't pass the typing test. You know, you have to be able to type like 30 words a minute. And I could on an electric typewriter. And they had these old archaic, you know, manual typewriters that you had to use a hammer and a chisel to get the A and the F key down. And it was so frustrating. So I failed the typing test. I failed the word knowledge test. So I had to go remediate in those things before I could even get into a class. Then I got into voice and diction with the famous Mr. Bob Runda, because of my regionalism and a lisp I had growing up in Wisconsin. You know, yeah, you know that guy from Sheboygan? I didn't do so well. And I had to get recycled in the voice and diction portion. So that was like the second time. And then I got recycled in radio, of all things. They had all these, you know, rules about having to make sure your show was tight and proper pronunciation and enunciation and the voice, and it had to be perfect. And so when I got to television, they're like, we can't recycle you anymore. You have to pass all these areas the first time. I was really nervous for the first time that what I thought was going to be a sure thing was almost out of my grasp. And I was fortunate that I got my passes and was able to move on. I remember sending my mom and dad a recording of Barry Manilow's I Made It Through the Rain because I passed. I'm very thankful that worked out, because I sure the heck have enjoyed everything since then.
Well, it just goes to show you that you don't have to be perfect right off the bat. And we learn through failure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we get back up and do it again. And the people who fail are the ones who don't keep trying.
Yep. That was the beginning of my resilience career at that point. I would be humbled many more times in my career because that cockiness returned time and time again, you know, until eventually you kind of realize you're always going to be learning, you know, in this career.
About 4 years after you attended the basic broadcast course at DINFOS, you attended the NPPA workshop in Norman, Oklahoma. NPPA stands for National Press Photographers Association. You were stationed at Soldiers Radio and Television, or SRTV at the time, which was then located at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. It is that course that you say you got bit by the NPPA bug. What did you learn at that workshop, and how did you apply it to your teaching and broadcasting career?
That was when I got a chance to go to NPPA. I didn't even know what NPPA was. And my boss, Clark Taylor, God rest his soul, said, "Hey, Lance, we want to send you and some other folks to this course to teach you how to be a better storyteller." And I was like, cool. And so I got there and I was considered a shooter. So I was a participant. And again, I thought because of my little bit of time in this career field doing TV that I might know a little bit about it. And I got such a wake up call there when Daryl Barton tore up my first, you know, product. It was just shockingly humiliating. And it's what I needed, right? It's what I needed to put me in my place and say, hey, you know, empty your cup out because we have a lot to teach you. And they did. And they taught about shot sequencing and action and reaction and lighting and interviewing and proper mic placement and all these things that are really important parts of telling a good story. And, you know, when I go back and when I think about, even right now, I think about it, it's like, how could I possibly tell stories when I could barely shoot video that made any sense instead of putting together a bunch of unrelated shots that don't tell a story, and how crucial those foundational things were. And so it was like they were tearing everything down and starting with like, all right, we got a slab of concrete. We can work with this now. And they tore it all down. And I was just so grateful leaving that, coming back and being able to apply what I've learned at SRTV while I was there until I left. And yeah, I was very fortunate that I had that experience. Again, it taught me that I didn't know what I thought I knew, how important those things are to being a better storyteller. So
it was about what, 5 years, 5, 6 years after that, that you ended up teaching at DINFOS.
Yeah, I took an assignment with the 25th Infantry Division Light Public Affairs Office, and that was about three years or so. And then after that, I got to come back and teach at DINFOS. But while I was in Hawaii, turned out I found out that DINFOS was developing a course based on the NPPA short course called the Advanced Electronic Journalism Course. And that really sparked my interest. I'm like, wow, I'm going back to teach. And it would be pretty cool if I got to teach that class. But I had no idea, you know, how things worked at DINFOS. So it was just a hope at the time. It was a hope, but, you know, because I didn't teaching, I had no idea how things worked there. So I was fortunate in that when, you know, they allowed me to actually take the advanced electronic journalism course before I started my instructor education. But the day I got to DINFOS, I walked into Mr. Tim Page's office and I walked up and found, I didn't know what he looked like or who he was. I finally found him and I introduced myself. I said, "Hi, I'm Sergeant Milstead. I'm going to be a teacher here and I want to teach the advanced electronic journalism course." And he was just like, kind of like, "I'm sorry, who are you? And what are you doing here?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm here to teach, but I'm taking the next AEJ course, but I want to teach that class." He's like, "Great. Why don't you just hold on and we'll get you through course and we'll get you into instructor certification and we'll go from there." So it turns out they had a process for vetting instructors. You know, everybody went in and tossed the basic class. They have to teach you how to teach first. And I think, you know, they were looking for the right people to teach that. And, you know, I was very fortunate that they must have seen something in me, because within 3 months after my certification, I was able to teach a class. I taught like the audio class. But a year later, I was on the primary staff for teaching that class. And I say a year later because a year after I got there, DINFOS at Fort Ben Harrison moved and closed as part of base realignment and closure. And we moved to Fort Meade. And when I got to Fort Meade, a lot of the staff that was teaching that stayed in Indiana. And I had the gift of taking over that class and standing it up at Fort Meade, which is like a dream come true, because, you know, I went out, we had to go out and find stories for students to shoot and play. And it was, we weren't rebuilding it. We were just reestablishing it. And then over the next 3 years, I increased the length of the course from 2 weeks to 4 weeks, so that the students could really have more time to gain and cement those skills that they were teaching. So yeah. And also during my time teaching there, I also introduced nonlinear editing into the curriculum for not just AEJ, but for the entire Defense Information School, because I had a friend who worked at Avid at the time and he taught me how to edit on a nonlinear editor. And I'm like, "Hey, why don't we use these here?" And we got one and then we got four. And then before I knew it, we had like 150. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah, I'll tell you, teaching AEJ was like one of the highlights of my time at Defense Information School. And what I ended up doing is bringing guest instructors from NPPA in to teach and be guest instructors at AEJC. So Daryl Barton, the guy that tore me down, I brought him in to talk to one of our classes. And I brought Julie Jones in, and I brought, you know, just people in the career field that were my idols, and they would come and speak to our classes. So this is fun to think about. It's so much fun. You know, and in that, I kept learning because I'd have students that came in that were really, really good. That's one of the great things I think I learned as an instructor is that just because I'm teaching this, there was so much I could learn from them. And I learned a lot from, you know, people that were coming in as students because they were so talented already.
I did an episode with the 180th Fighter Wing in Toledo. It's an Ohio National Guard F-16 unit. So I retired from there. I was the editor of their newsletter. So I went back and did a podcast with the staff, which was really cool because I know that our members, our MVJ members, are former military, they're veterans, but not all of them come from the journalism career like we did.
Yeah.
But it is an option to get out if you were something else in the military and then consider going back in the Guard in journalism. And then they will send you to DINFOS because all of the 180th staff, you know, were DINFOS trained killers. So that's another reason I wanted to do this podcast about DINFOS is because it's an option that our veterans can consider. How many courses total did you teach there, and how long were you there as an instructor?
I started teaching the basic broadcasting course that everybody started teaching that class. I taught the advanced electronic journalism course, and I also taught the broadcast manager's course. I primarily taught that my second time around teaching. So my first stint teaching at DINFOS ended in 1999, so I was there for 5 years. And I got out of the military, went into the commercial world for a few years, working in a variety of companies. I mentioned Abbott. I worked for them for a while. And then I worked for some production companies. And then I got called back to active duty because I stayed in the inactive ready reserve and 9/11 happened. They needed broadcast journalists to fill in MPADs, mobile public affairs detachments that were serving overseas. It's funny because I'd reached out to, at the time, Sergeant Major Ray Cordell, who was one of the sergeant majors in our career field. He was a retrainee, as a matter of fact, meaning he came from another MOS and became a public affairs broadcast journalist. And I asked him if they needed anybody down at OCPA, Office of the Chief of Public Affairs at the Pentagon, for reserve stints, because I was trying to get some of my reserve time done. He goes, no. And I said, what do you think about, you think they're going to call, you know, broadcast journalists back up? He goes, nah, they're looking for trigger pullers. And kid you not, 2 weeks later, I got a letter in the mail assigning me back to Fort Meade to get, you know, retrained. I show up and they're letting me stay at the NCO Academy. I walked in and he was there speaking to the class. He goes, what are you doing here? And I was in uniform. I said, they called me up. He goes, no kidding. So it was happening a lot because the mobile public affairs detachments were deploying. And you know, if they didn't have people that could deploy, they had to fill them in. So I was cross-leveled into that unit to fill it in and make it whole so we could deploy. Long way of getting around to the fact is after I spent a year in Iraq, Ron Rayhorn, who was my supervisor before I got out in 99, said, hey, Lance, do you want to come back and teach again as a reserve instructor? And I was like, heck yeah. And that worked out great. So in 2006, I started teaching again, and I taught until 2009 when I retired, teaching AEJ again and the broadcast manager's course. And then eventually I moved in as the NCOIC of the broadcast operations and maintenance department. But even though I was doing that, I still asked if I could teach because it's just fun, rewarding. Fun's kind of just not enough. Rewarding is the better part, you know, especially, you know, when you see some of your students go on to do great things. And it's just like, wow, that's pretty cool. And not because of anything I did, but just, you know, it's part of teaching people to have a passion for this thing called storytelling, you know, especially when it comes to our service members.
You believe that everyone has a story to tell. And an important part of journalism is to tell those stories, to make people feel something, to get to know the subjects of her stories and to ensure we stay out of the way and let them tell their stories. As you know, many of our members transition out of the military with non-journalism jobs to seek a job in journalism. Can you put on your instructor hat and talk more about the vital importance of storytelling?
I haven't had a chance a couple times to actually speak at graduations now, even when I was an instructor there. But after I left and started working at DMA, I've been able to go back and talk to classes about storytelling and their jobs. And, you know, you're talking to a basic class. And I acknowledge when I start talking to them, I'm like, you know, I can't tell you what my graduation speaker said to me. And you may forget almost everything I tell you today. And the thing I don't want you to forget is how important your job is as a military broadcaster, as a storyteller. And then I go on to tell them about a story. When I went to Iraq, after the first couple weeks I was there, maybe the first month, I got to embed with the 73rd Engineer Company, part of Deuce 4. Was part of, had an area of operation in Mosul, Iraq. And I spent a week with these guys. And one day I was doing a story about IED hunters, these engineers that go out and they actually look for IEDs, clear routes, and make sure it's safe for convoys. I got to know this young kid who was really enthusiastic about what they're doing. And on one of the missions, we were coming back and we took fire. And I kind of got down and was videotaping. He was above me looking around to see who was shooting at us. And the gunner on the back of the Striker we were going to, you know, took out the guy who was shooting at us. We all run back, get in the vehicle. I sit down, turn the, you know, the camera was on because I was filming while I was running, and I sit down, he's sitting across from me, and I just look at him and I said, what are you feeling right now? And he goes on to say, man, this is what it's all about. You know, we're out here, we cleared those rockets from that thing. This place is safe now. And, you know, he says, what we do is important here. You know, you could see it and you could feel it as he's telling this, that he believes in what he's doing, you know, in the mission that we had over there and the specific mission that they had of making things safe for everybody else. The sad part of that is 2 months later, he was killed in an IED attack, doing the very thing that we were doing that day, but he didn't survive. And because this is not because of me, but because of the role that we have as storytellers, he was in the story I did about the IED hunters. I used that soundbite because it's very illustrative of this mission that they have. I was able to send that to his family, along with all the B-roll that I'd shot of him. And they got this as a bit of a gift to say, you know, to see that their son was doing something that he believed in for his country. And I tell that to students who are graduating because I want them to go out there and know that you're not just putting a camera on your shoulder or in your hand and you're hit and go, and then you're putting something together that's 90 seconds long that no one's going to watch. If you think of that, if you think that's what you're doing, go find another job. Because that's not what you're doing. You're telling very real human side of our service members and what they do on a day-to-day basis. And that's just one example, right? But for me, it's a powerful one because, you know, it ends in a sad story, but there was something for his parents to see and watch about the kid who really believed in what he was doing. So that's the power we have, right? To tell those stories. And that story in itself was a little exciting. Didn't necessarily, wasn't a tearjerker, but they're not always that way. Sometimes they are. That one just happened to be something that would really mean something to a family later down the road. But that's the thing about the telling stories. It's like, they're human. That's when you find the human side of these things that people can relate to that stuff, you know?
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but there was a point in your career when you thought you knew everything about storytelling, but then you attended the NPPA workshop. And you said that experience changed your life, that you were introduced to humility and started to understand the craft of storytelling. And I can hear that in the stories you've told, that you just told us. What exactly brought you to that realization? And how were you introduced to humility, which I think is actually pretty paramount as a journalist? And sometimes we forget about humility.
That's like asking how many times have you been humbled, Lance? I'll stick with my career because there's been moments of humility in my marriage and as a parent and as a father when you realize that you thought you had it figured out and you didn't. It's kind of an ongoing case study of humility because it happened when I joined and went to DINFOS and thought I knew all this about broadcasting and didn't know Jack, right? And after a couple of more years, I'm doing TV stories in Korea and think I'm doing a good job because really I'm not getting any feedback. And then I go to this short course and realize I don't know anything. And then when you start teaching, it was sort of this thing where you realize that, hey, I know how much I don't know because I have to teach this. And you really have to kind of relearn it so that you can speak confidently. So you there are teachers who teach who still don't know what they're teaching, and you can tell, right? And then there are teachers who, like my dad was a teacher, and his students, you know, they just did a, he taught industrial arts, and his students made things like grandfather clocks and kayaks and water beds, and he let them do whatever they wanted. And a lot of times my dad didn't know how to do the things they wanted to do. And so that was a great example of humility, because he'd say, well, I don't know how to bend wood to make a kayak, but let's learn together. And it's when you have that mentality that it's like, hey, even though I'm the instructor, you may come in here with more skills than me and have something to offer that I can put in my toolkit, which is a term I always use as we start an AEJ class. I'm like, you guys all have toolboxes, and we're here to give you tools. You got some already, and you may have some tools that I don't have, but we probably have some that you don't have, and you can choose which ones you want to take with you and which ones don't work. And we talked about that a lot because we had people coming from certain commands and they're like, well, our boss won't let us do stories like that. And I'm like, okay, well then don't take that piece and set it aside until you can go somewhere where you can use that, but find something here that applies to what you do. And if you can't find something, or it is the answer, the question is do you want to find something that you can use, or are you just dead set on not getting anything from this class? That's what hinders us, is when we get somewhere where we think we can't be taught anything. I went to a leadership class that when I got to DMA, I was working for Army Production. They sent me to an executive leadership development class. And I walked into that and thought to myself, I've had a career in the Army. I know a lot about leadership. But I quickly sidelined that because I knew if I went in with that mentality, I wouldn't learn what's possibly waiting for me at the end of this course. And I'm so glad I did, you know. So those are, I think over time, you know, we don't have to eat that humble pill as much anymore because we've been through it so many times. I mean, hopefully we learn from those experiences, right?
Well, I'm sure other people listening to this might be in the beginning stages of learning humility. I think it's something that you learn as you meet other people. You know, as a journalist, we need to relate to them and not look down on them and not think of them as just a story.
Yeah. That, you know, there's two people that I loved watching their stories and I just look at as icons. For me, it was Bob Dodson and Steve Hartman, both in the unique way. Bob Dodson is just, he is such a brilliant writer, and the way he tells the story and uses his voice and inflection, just, and Steve Hartman too, and seeing Steve and a number of the way he broaches stories, watching him with kids or old people and putting himself in the story and relating to those people in a way that just makes them completely comfortable, and they're masters at their craft. And so when I look at them and go, I have so much to learn, but yet, you know, we would show their stories and then break them down with the students and say, what is it about this that works? Or, and, you know, it could be like how they ask questions or how they use a non-question question to get people to be comfortable with their interview style. It was just, you know, there's so much to learn from them. And it's just, you know, watching their stories is just fun. I've met Bob Dodson a couple times. He's been kind enough, as I've complimented him about his goals and or his milestones in his career, to write me back. And we've, you know, he's been to DINFOS and visited and was a guest speaker at one point. So Steve Hartman is a guy I never met. I met and had his cameraman, Les Rose, come and talk about how they approached telling stories. Because Steve Hartman, I don't know if you ever heard of him, he used to throw a dart at a map. And his thing was, everyone's got a story. And it was the coolest thing. And it was just, it was a great example of how once he found someone that would talk to him, he'd find a story. Even that in and of itself is just proof that, you know, when you take time to sit and talk to somebody and then really listen, most people have something pretty cool about themselves to talk about. It's been a while since I've been in this storytelling mode, being a director of production services. I like my job, but I'm removed from that. So now thinking of it, it just reminds me of how much fun that was and how cool it was to take on people's stories and tell them.
Speaking of your job, what is the defense media activity where you work, and what do you do as the chief of production services?
You know, without having a textbook vision statement of the defense media activity, I like to think of it as the mothership for all of the production entities in, you know, in the Department of Defense at the service secretary level, if you will. So we have, you know, the production houses for Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, the DOD, and the Pentagon Bureau. And those production houses provide content and help with the strategic communication goals for their clients, which are the service secretaries. Production Services has a little bit wider breadth of clients. Our primary clients are really the Secretary of Defense and the four-star combatant commands, like, you know, UCOM, CENTCOM. There's a list of the comms. We serve the production houses, but we also reach out and serve those clients with support with their live streaming events. We do a lot of graphics. Our graphics team does all the social media graphics for the SecDef and the DepSecDef. We have our broadcast operations recording group, which is involved daily with streaming briefings. If the SecDef's talking in Ukraine about something going on over there, we're streaming that worldwide so people can hear and be a part of that. We also produce content. We just had I think it's Stratcom, is looking to do a project with us, and we'll send a crew there and help them tell their whatever that story is. We don't do training videos. We've had a lot of people say, we need a training video. I'm like, it's not what we do. Our content has to help meet the strategic communication needs of our clients, which are a lot of the senior clients in the Department of Defense.
So, last question. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know? Any advice for our members who are just beginning their journalism careers, especially in broadcast journalism?
Yeah, I'd say they should know what their why is. Why are you doing this job as a broadcast journalist or military, whether you're a military journalist or I say regular, right? I shouldn't say that because we're all journalists. I think there's been this thought that military journalists are different from civilian journalists. I mean, okay, we can't do investigative reporting, but we do tell stories. And I think understanding what your why is, like, why is this important to you? You know, there's probably some value or something in you that you feel strongly about being a journalist and getting out there and exposing and telling a story about something that's important to you or important to the client that you're serving, and understanding what your why is. For me, it was making sure that the American public had a really good idea of the amazing people that serve our country. Because I had friends I went to school with that didn't really understand some of the things the military did. And I had an important part in helping share that. Whether I'm telling stories about, you know, soldiers and their roles and what they play, or whether I was a station manager, making sure that we providing, you know, good traffic information to people that are commuting that day, and entertainment, you know, part of radio is entertainment because people like music and we got to provide that. It's a, you know, people should know their why when they're getting into that. And then, you know that they're going to have a career that's fraught with challenges and flubs and mistakes and pain, right? There's pain in this life and this journey. The question is, what are you going to do with it? And if those failures are left as failures and you don't learn anything from it, then it's a failure. If the failure is something you've learned from, then you've benefited from it. You become better at your craft. You know, you get those takeaways every time you run into a brick wall or drop something or screw something up. You can humbly go, hey, this was my issue. I need to get better at this. Help me do that. Or you can wallow in your whatever you're feeling, and you never get any better. So I think, you know, that's something to consider moving into it. And it's some advice going through it that, you know, look at those as opportunities to get better at what you do, and you will.
Yeah. And sometimes don't take no for an answer, even though you think you might be qualified. A lot of our members are going into civilian journalism after being in the military.
Yeah.
And they don't have a portfolio and they don't have a journalism degree. That's what our organization does, is we train them and we give them the resources. We have a mentorship program and we have fellowship opportunities and we have podcasts like this with guests like you who give them advice. So thank you.
And I would say even if they don't have a portfolio, I mean, I'd worked in the commercial industry too. I worked at NBC Universal while I was waiting in between the military. I was an editor. In fact, Nora O'Donnell was working there. You mentioned her earlier, and she was working there as a journalist before she got that promotion up to the network. The point is, you know, I think take what you got, go in with some confidence and say, hey, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, and I'm going to be a benefit to your organization. It's funny you brought this up because I was just talking to my team members about, we're doing our evaluations, and it's like, hey, make sure that you put some information there about what you did this year. It said, it's just like a job interview. You go in and you're trying to sell those people on why you are the person that they should hire, you know, especially if you get to the point where you get the interview. Don't waste that, you know, understand what that organization does. I mean, I interview people for work at my organization. And when I ask the question, so tell me a little bit, what do you know about DMA? And they go, I really don't. I'm like, really? You didn't do your homework, buddy. So I think, you know, for this generation that's coming up, you know, be prepared to sell yourself and have a couple of really cool highlights about who you are and what you do and believe in yourself and sell that. That's important for people who are hiring people to see if they got some, you know, a little fire in their belly and a passion and belief in themselves and confidence.
On that note, that wraps up another episode of The Sword and Pen, a podcast that supports and trains our military veterans in journalism so we can get more vets into American newsrooms. Thank you, Lance Milstead, for sharing your story and giving our members tips and tricks of the trade and confidence. If you want to hear more military veterans, journalists, photojournalists, authors on this podcast, please subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss an episode. We would really appreciate it. I am your host, Lori King. You're dismissed.